Welcome to our panel on the Noel Canning case. I think should be a very interesting discussion. We have an excellent group here, I think. To the far right, we have Noel Francisco. Noel and I go back about 16 years. We clerked together. He is representing the Noel Canning Corporation in its challenge to President Obama's recess appointees. Obviously, that case is now in front of the Supreme Court. Noel's a graduate of the University of Chicago, and I was at dinner last night with Richard Epstein, and who was one of Noel's professors, and he did attribute all of your success, Noel, to the fact that you took his class in Roman law.
Yes.
So, you know, we got that squared away. Noel clerked for Justice Scalia. He is currently chair of Jones Day government regulation practice. And he's been on lots of TV shows. Hardball with Chris Matthews. Did he let you talk at all? Yeah, I can't even watch that show, much less contemplate what it's like to be on it. Nightline, Larry King Live, etc. So we're very fortunate to have Noel with us. We also have John Radabaugh next to Noel here. John is an expert on labor law, a former member of the NLRB, so he can bring that perspective to our discussion. Obviously, the Noel Canning case involves three recess appointments to that board. He's a graduate of the University of Virginia Law School and is currently an attorney, has a dual role. He's an attorney at the National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation and also is a professor of labor law at the Ave Maria Law School down in Naples, Florida. To my left is another old friend, John Elwood. John is currently a partner at Vinson and Elkins here in Washington, and he argued a case in front of the Supreme Court on Tuesday, so he's coasting down from that. He's a graduate of Yale Law School. He clerked for Justice Kennedy, and he served for 7 years as, let's see what your position was in the, you were an assistant to the SG, and he was also an OLC for a combined 7 years. So he'll bring that perspective, and particularly in the OLC, Office of Legal Counsel, John worked on issues related to recess appointments. That's okay to say, right? And a couple of judicial appointments that were recess appointments, which were somewhat of a novelty at that time. And Elizabeth Wydra is with us. She is the chief counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, which, as I see in your brief, you say is a think tank and public interest law firm dedicated to fulfilling the progressive promise of our court's text and history.
Constitution's text.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
I know you all think that liberals don't care about that, so I just want to make sure we did it.
Yeah, well, that's what I get for writing it down rather than bringing up the actual document. So your group is interesting in the fact that they bring a textual and historical focus to constitutional arguments, advocating for more progressive outcomes than originalists typically do. Elizabeth is also a graduate of Yale Law School. She clerked for Judge James Browning on the Ninth Circuit, and she practiced law in San Francisco with Kathleen Sullivan for a while in their Supreme Court practice. And she, too, has been on lots of TV shows, NBC, ABC, Fox. I saw you and Tom Dupre look that up, and that was fun. Talking about the Voting Rights Act. So we're very fortunate to have each of them here today. The way it's going to work is I'm going to have each of them give an opening statement for 8 or 10 minutes. It's going to follow the order in which they're seated, beginning with Noel. And then I'll ask some questions of the panel, perhaps sort of the way I would at oral argument. And then we'll turn it over to some questions from the audience. So Noel, if you want to come on up.
Thank you, Judge Kethledge, and thanks to the Federalist Society for inviting me to be here. You know, I know I've arrived when I've actually been invited to sit on a panel at the Federal Society Lawyers Convention. I've actually had more of an opportunity to serve Elizabeth's role at the American Constitutional Society than I have actually here, so I'm glad to be here, and I also very much appreciate, Elizabeth, your joining us, because I know how tough it is sometimes to be in that seat at an organization like this, and we welcome the perspective that you have to bring to these types of events. I think what I'm going to do first is really set the stage for the case and then talk a little bit about it, but more what I'm going to do is explain how we got to where we are today and give you a sense for what my position is going to be before the Supreme Court. I don't want to give too much of it away because my brief is due on Monday, and in case Curtis Gannon or anyone else from the SG's office is lurking in the wings, I don't want to give them a three-day head start. So. We're here about the recess appointments clause, and I'll read it to you. It's very short. The president shall have power to fill up all vacancies that may happen during the recess of the Senate by granting commissions which shall expire at the end of their next session. From December 17, 2011 to January 23, 2012, the Senate was convening in what are often called pro forma sessions. That's where every 3 days they gavel into session. There's really nothing going on, so they very quickly gavel out of session. And they were doing this pursuant to an adjournment order that indicated that no business would be conducted during those so-called pro forma sessions. During the sessions that occurred during that period, two things happened. One, the Senate passed and the President signed the Temporary Payroll Tax Cut Extension Act. And secondly, on January 3rd, the Senate convened in accordance with the 20th Amendment of the Constitution to commence the second session of the 112th Congress. That was on January 3rd when they convened in accordance with the 20th Amendment. The very next day on January 4th, President Obama purported to make three recess appointments to the National Labor Relations Board, and those appointments were critical because without them, the NLRB would have lacked a lawful quorum and therefore could not have done any business. 2 days after that, the Senate convened in another pro forma session, and so on until the end of that period. So that really is the factual background behind this case. You had the Senate convening in these so-called pro forma sessions every 3 days, including one that triggered, and this is kind of important to the case, the beginning of the second session of the 112th Congress, which made the appointment the following day an intra-session recess appointment, that is, an appointment that occurred during the Senate's enumerated session. 2 days after that, you had the Senate convene another pro forma session. So the question is that appointment that occurred during that window a lawful appointment under the recess appointments clause that I just read to you? The board, including the three members that the president recess appointed, then proceeded, as the National Labor Relations Board does, to issue a slew of orders against a variety of companies, one of which was the aptly named Noel Canning Company. The Noel Canning Company is my client, along with Rachel Brand at the National Chamber Litigation Center and a gentleman named Gary Laughlin, who is their local counsel out in Washington. And we stepped into the case right around that time to jointly represent the Noel Canning Company, and that's what brings us before the Supreme Court today. And I'm very grateful to the Chamber and to Gary for joining together with me to bring this case. But that factual background is what gives rise to the three issues that the Supreme Court has decided to address when it comes to the legality of these recess appointments. And it's interesting because there are very few areas that where you get before the Supreme Court and there is not a single Supreme Court decision that is directly on point or even remotely on point. The Supreme Court has actually never issued an opinion with respect to the recess appointments clause. So we get there at least from a jurisprudential perspective in the Supreme Court, writing on largely a clean slate. So the first of the three issues is, when must the vacancy arise in order to be eligible for a recess appointment in the first place? For the first three decades of this country, it was uniformly understood that the vacancy had to arise during the recess in which the appointment was made. That was the position taken by the Washington administration, the Jefferson administration, the Adams administration and the Monroe administration. 3 decades into the country, the president abandoned that limitation and has been off to the races since. The second question is, when is the recess of the Senate? What period of time constitutes the recess of the Senate? For the first 130 years of the country, the presidents basically and uniformly acknowledged that the recess was not during the session. Those were mutually exclusive periods. You were either in the recess or the session. And with one exception, they all understood that the recess constituted that break that fell in between enumerated sessions. The one exception was Andrew Johnson, but even Andrew Johnson's attorney general explained that they were mutually exclusive periods. So you couldn't be in both the recess and the session at the same time. That actually has significance in terms of how long a recess appointment lasts. So there we had a pretty much uniform understanding for 130 years. And then the president abandoned that limitation. The third question is the Senate in the recess of the Senate when it is actively convening sessions every 3 days, holding these so-called pro forma sessions? For the first 223 years of the country, presidents acknowledged, or at least acted under the acknowledgement, that they could not make recess appointments when the Senate was in fact convening every 3 days in accordance with a different clause of the Constitution, the adjournment clause, including when it was satisfying that through pro forma sessions. Pro forma sessions are not new. There have been hundreds of them throughout the country's history, including in modern times. Yet, for the first 223 years of the country, no president attempted to make a recess appointment when the Senate was in fact convening in these sessions every 3 days. That ended on January 4th, 2012, when President Obama made the 3 recess appointments to the National Labor Relations Board. So there we see, after 223 years, the executive has jettisoned the third limitation on the recess appointments clause. I think you could probably see a pattern here. So that's what tees up these 3 issues before the Supreme Court. Are these appointments, which were made during a session, not in between sessions, that were made to vacancies that occurred long before the recess, not during the recess, and that were filled while the Senate was actually convening into sessions every 3 days, were these recess appointments constitutional? The government's position in this case is, and they basically look to the plain meaning of the word recess, and they look at old dictionary definitions, and they say that a recess occurs whenever the Senate takes any break from its usual business. Well, of course, that would mean lunchtime, that would mean overnight, that would mean over the course of the weekend. In fact, if you look at the Senate records, they generally say we're going into recess from 12 until 2 while we eat lunch, from 5 tonight until 9 tomorrow morning while we break overnight, and from 6 o'clock Friday until 10 o'clock on Tuesday or Monday over the weekend. So the government's position really would mean you could make a recess appointment during any of these periods, but they recognize that that's not tenable. So they've created a de minimis rule that says that, well, probably if it's less than 3 days, that's de minimis, and we wouldn't consider that a recess. So plain meaning, subject to a de minimis exception. But think about what that rule means. That means that even under the most generous understanding of the government's rule, the president can make a recess appointment during any 3-day break in the action. Well, this is where I would ask that you take a step back and look at how the Constitution is structured and how the appointments process is structured. The appointments power was described at the time of the founding as one of the most insidious tools of oppression. Whether or not we think that's an overstatement, that's how it was described at the time. And that's why the framers hotly debated where to lodge the power of appointment. And there were 3 options on the table. One was to give it to the president alone, one was to give it to the Senate alone, and one was to divide it up and give half of it to each of them. And as we know in the Appointments Clause, the framers adopted that third compromise. We're going to split that power and give it to both branches. And that's kind of extraordinary. It's one of the very few instances in our Constitution where we see an executive power a traditionally executive power that is split between the executive and the legislature. I think the only other example I can think of is the treaty power. So that was a very deliberate choice and a hotly debated one. And the purpose of it was to ensure that those who wield the awesome power of the federal government were those for whom there was a widespread consensus, both on the part of the presidency and on the part of the Senate. That was the main purpose of the appointments clauses of the Constitution, to require Senate consent. The recess appointments clause, in contrast, let me ask, does anybody know how much debate was taken up during the convention over the recess appointments clause? The answer is zero. There was no debate at all. It was adopted at the very end, unanimously, without discussion. So the question is, do these clauses, when you put them together, do they really mean that the president gets to make a unilateral appointment during every break in the Senate action, at least if it is 3 days long? Could that possibly be what they meant? I think that the answer to that is clearly no. And that's why when you look at how things unfolded, you saw for the first 30 years, everybody understood that there was one limit and it got taken away, but they still recognized another limit for the next 150, and then yet another for the next 223, because they all recognized that the recess appointments clause is meant to be a rare exception, not the general rule. Yet in this case, the government wants to sweep away every one of those limits and have a unilateral appointment power during, at best, every three-day break in the action. I really don't think that's a tenable position. I know I've taken up most of my time. I'm going to leave it to Professor Radabaugh to explain to you why, as a textual and historical matter, I'm right. And if there's any lingering concern, I'd encourage you to read our brief, which is going to be filed on Monday.
Good afternoon. I am not a constitutional law professor. I'm a labor law professor, so I'm going to focus on this issue in that context. In terms of the originalist meaning, I think it's interesting. I did inquire from my 10th grade son and his colleagues, and they thought it was quite clear. Everyone in school knows the difference between recess and a class session. So, anywho, what I'd like to point out is several of the practical issues. First of all, I think if you begin with the statistic that the actual nomination of the two board members on the 15th of December, 2011, was followed 2 days later by the adjournment. And so the Senate technically had 2 days, possibly, before the adjournment to provide their advice. This gives new meaning to yesterday's oral argument in Mull Hall. And I would remind the president that the intangible value of railroading the Senate and avoiding the constitutional process was indeed a thing of value. Mr. President, the process of bringing in these recess appointees also worked havoc on the mission of the board. It has been the tradition of the National Labor Relations Board since its founding in 1935 that only a five-member board will participate in the overturning of a case precedent. And with this board, with the recess effort of, I don't know whether it's President Obama or Richard Trumka, but at any rate, together, they were able to overturn precedent in situations where not only was it without five members, but if the recess appointments are deemed to be unconstitutional as a result of your winning argument, the number of cases that will have been decided that need to be essentially returned. Now, the technical number is 1,718. That includes published and non-published decisions, and of course, many of those will have been followed and resolved and not contested. But that's the number of cases that issued under this technical unconstitutional board. The other action of the board that is rather shocking is the precedent that they overturned, not only with recess appointees, but without a full five-member board. And this is something that has concerned labor lawyers and certainly former members of the NLRB. It's really rather shocking to think that you would just ignore the 78-year history of this institution. But what they have done, when you look back over the cases, they have challenged the approach that the board has taken for years in resolving the Section 211 definition of supervisor, as they apply that in both unfair labor practice cases and particularly in representation cases, as to whether or not someone is a supervisor determines whether they would be included in the unit and vote for or against the union or not. They also struck down a rule that an employer had a local rule that said that using now standard TV language that your grandparents thought, or certainly my parents thought, was totally inappropriate, rude, crude, and ugly, was now not. And they overturned a long history of decisions in terms of board review of employer decisions as whether it impacts protected concerted activity, and they found that using the F word and all other kinds of inappropriate language and making essential arguments that would you could characterize as threats, that that's no longer an unfair, that it would be an unfair labor practice for an employer to discipline employees now for engaging in that kind of behavior. Another quite shocking decision, again, not by a full five-member board, and also, in my opinion, by an absolutely outrageously unlawful board, they then decided a case that said that when a collective bargaining agreement ends by the agreed-upon term, that an employer now has a continuing obligation to deduct dues from the represented employees and provide it to the union. So if you're wondering at all why the labor movement is now down to 6.6% of the private sector and yet still able to fund massive lobbying efforts, now you know how that works. Once you get into their pocket, apparently you stay in their pocket. We also had a litany of cases come forward by this particular board that took an entirely different direction on social media. Again, without a five-member board to overturn precedent by the history of the board. We also have a situation quite that has engaged employment lawyers across the country in D.R. Horton, where the this group of people decided that despite the Supreme Court's decision in American Express that it was an unfair labor practice if you didn't allow employees to go to the board despite having signed waivers and channeling it through arbitration. So they've done some significant things here. Where we are at this point is if you look at the number of cases that the new five-member board has decided, at the rate of productivity to date, there will be a total of 34 published cases for the fiscal year. This action against the board is significant. it needs to proceed, and then what needs to follow is a serious effort to discuss and amend and bring the National Labor Relations Act into the 21st century. It's critical. The actions by the board at this point, I think, in the opinion of many, many, many observers, whether you're union, management, left, right, whatever, is working on a political agenda and not attempting to apply the National Labor Relations Act to fact patterns that come before the board. The decisions that were issued, when you go through them, I've analyzed each and every case, and on that handout, I don't know if you saw it, I put it on that chair there, there's a listing of all of the cases and emphasizing those that are objectionable in the context of having overturned precedent. But with that, I will leave that to you inside the Beltway people, and hopefully we can get this fixed. Thank you very much.
I'm just glad that my peripheral vision isn't good enough that I can see myself on these giant screens. So the perspective I come at this from is I was a G-man for many years, and from the point of view of people who thought, yes, you can make that Reese's appointment. That's pretty much what I did. Yeah, sounds good. And one of the things that's kind of liberating here is I no longer have a dog in this fight, which after, it's a wonderfully freeing position, because if somebody says something that makes sense, you can go, yeah, that sounds right to me. And it's just a great position to be in where, you know, because I don't have a dog in the fight, I get to be just an interested observer in what is, I think, one of the most interesting doctrinal cases in just ages, and a case that's great for people who are law nerds and originalists. This is great because, you know, there hasn't been that much practice, or rather the courts haven't really addressed it, and so the original sources are the most important things. And so this is just a great case to watch, and as we will get to, I think it's even more important, or it's even more fun, because it doesn't matter very much. And it certainly matters to people who have NLRB orders, but as we'll get to later, I don't think it matters that much for the executive branch. So I'll go in order of the same order that Noel used. The happens to arise, happens to exist. Now, I'll be very interested to see what happens with this, because I have a lot of respect for Noel. I'll just pause now to see if anybody laughs. No. And I'd be very interested to see what he digs up, because I'm sure that they are digging up the best evidence that can be had. The government asserts in a fairly plausible way that even though it's true, the early attorneys general did not think very much of the argument that the government is making here, that they thought when the vacancies happened during the recess of the Senate, that meant happened to arise. Which turned over in 1823 to, since then, the Attorney General, I think it was Wirt. Since then, all the Attorneys General have dutifully said happens to exist is an acceptable interpretation. And one of the things that's interesting is to believe the government's brief, the early presidents didn't take much stock in their early Attorney General's positions because they argue that President Washington made Reese's appointments to fill vacancies that didn't exist at the time. That pre-existed the recess of the Senate, and that was Adams's position too. He was a very distinguished lawyer in his own right, although I don't think he made them. That Jefferson probably made them, and that Madison made them. And I am completely agnostic about whether they existed or not, but they are at least asserting that. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with it. But it is pretty clear that the pedigree since 1823 has been distinctly in the executive branch, at least, has been, yeah, we have the right to do that, which will surprise no one that a branch takes an interpretation that favors it. The one thing I will say in this score, well, two things, is it would be a peculiar thing to say at a time when communications were so terrible that if the vacancy arose before the recess of the Senate, but because communications were terrible, you didn't find out about it until the recess of the Senate, that you would be disempowered from making a recess appointment to fill it, because presumably it would be just as important to fill that one as one that arose during the recess. There might be other reasons to do it that way, such as to avoid the very situation we have now, which is that they use recesses as the opportunity to get through all the guys who couldn't get through before. And maybe that was the founder's plan, but it is at least a question that is worth asking. I think as an originalist matter, this is one of the more appealing arguments for Noel, because when you say a vacancy happening, when you first think of it, you think, well, that means the guy retired or croaked. It happens to arise reading. But the happens to exist is a phrase that only a lawyer can say, less ridiculous than it may seem on first look. Like, for example, if you say, well, when did the most recent vacancy happen in the vice presidency? And one answer to that might be August 8th, 1974, when Nixon stepped down. But another answer, which doesn't seem that unusual, would be, August to December, until they got the next vice president in the office. And a vacancy happened in the office. You know what the longest vacancy was in the office of the vice president? The whole time, Andrew Johnson never had a vice president, which is, when you think about it, sounds even more dysfunctional than today. In any event, I think that this is an argument that, I will reserve judgment because I have the luxury of doing that. But this is something where, generally speaking, I'm relatively with the administration, which is why I'm on this side of the podium. Now, intercession. One of the things that's kind of interesting is, as Noel says, they didn't make any intra-session recess appointments until Andrew Johnson administration. Which is, generally speaking, that's not where you want to go for, precedence, just because nobody thought very highly of him outside of his immediate family. But the reason for that was they didn't really take a lot of inter-session recesses. There were something like five of them before the Johnson administration of any length. Because you think about it, when Congress, it used to be a big hairy deal to get into and out of town, and so they just didn't show up. When they were there, they got their work done, and then they went home. And the real recesses were the intercession ones. But one thing that I think is important here is that when you look at the meaning that early legislative bodies assigned to recesses, there's plenty of indication that they thought intra-session recesses were recesses too, which happened more on the state level because it's not such an ordeal to go to and from. The fact of the matter is, though, it just doesn't look very good when you have basically an island in the 1860s, and then you really have to go well into the 20th century before it happens. And it's made uglier by the fact that the early 20th century attorneys general didn't think much of the theory. And so the government is going to have to do some, dancing around that. One thing that's kind of interesting, as Noel notes, there's basically the government has more or less grudgingly carved out a three-day exception, because once you bind to the idea that a recess is a recess, then there's a question, why can't you recess appoint somebody over lunch? And the government has, inside OLC, we have our own precedents, which may have no basis in logic, but they are at least precedents. And one of them is, a substantial recess, that's tantamount to, an intercession recess. You can make it during that amount of time. And so 10 days was usually kind of the rule that people actually used. And giving thumbs up to a recess, and the 20 days or whatever, if you take out the pro formas, more on that later, I think that would be definitely well within the wheelhouse of what OLC would say, sounds good, boss, for a recess. The thing is, that may seem very familiar to those of us who served in the executive branch in an OLC, but I'll be very interested to see whether that gets any traction with the justices who are viewing this as an originalist matter. And whether you really have to say it has to be a substantial period or not. But that's something where, I tend to favor the administration, but I can see the vulnerabilities because you really are talking about voluntary disarmament above 3 days, and nobody really thinks that the president should be able to make three-day recess appointments. Finally, on to pro forma sessions. And this is an area where you would think that I would be most heavily aligned with the administration, seeing as they cite me in their brief. I wrote an op-ed piece with Steve Bradbury, who was my boss at OLC, and I think that, if you ever want to see him engage in like an extended coughing fit, ask him about the op-ed, because now I think that his official position is that was his evil twin who wrote that. But But, you know, I haven't walked away from it yet, because that's the great thing is when I'm not representing a client, I can do the whole sort of, hey, that sounds good to me. I can change my position however frequently I want. I'm also not afraid of looking foolish, evidently. And I will say that, you know, this looked a lot different. It's true, it was an old says, pro forma sessions have been used a long time for various purposes. But until like 2006 or 2007, I think, it had never been used basically just to shut down the recess appointment process. They had threatened it during the Reagan administration for that purpose, but it hadn't really been used for that purpose. And you know, when you look at it, there are certain things about it that look really kind of unseemly in some ways, in that, for example, the Senate makes provision for its own recess appointments during that time. That they usually in these recess orders they say, well, if we need to make any appointments, then the majority leader can make them, whatever. They do things that suggest that they really know that they're out. So I think that is a bad thing for Noel's side, for the challenger side. But I will say that there's a kind of a confluence of unfortunate circumstances for the president in this particular recess appointment. For starters, not only did they pass a law in what would be considered the same recess under the government's theory, and that the only thing separating them was pro forma sessions, but they did it once earlier that year, remember, to keep all the air traffic controllers on the job. And so it wasn't just a fluke. It looks pretty substantial. I will say this, you know, during a moot of Noel on this case, I learned a fact which really, I won't say shook me up, because it suggests I'm more invested in this than I am. But one thing that really impressed me is, I believe this is to be the case, that, you know, it may be James Webb or whatever, you know, poor senator lives closest and has to come in and bang the gavel for 30 seconds, who's doing it. And it's maybe an empty floor otherwise, as far as senators go. But behind them are the people, the staffers, who need to be there to pass legislation. And so if Harry Reid got on the phone and said, we got a unanimous consent this, you know, they could go from 0 to 60 pretty fast, and I think they could get it done. And at that point, it looks a lot less like the Senate is unavailable, which is the whole theory why you can recess appoint somebody during a pro forma recess, because it just has the form of a Senate, a form of a Senate session, but it isn't one. It just has the form of one. And it looks a lot more like, we're not handling the president's appointments because we don't want to. And that sounds like, you know, what the Senate's job is to do, not give consent when they don't think it's a good idea. Now, this seems like a good point for me to stop, but I won't. I still have a few more observations.
You're almost out of time. So.
Oh, sorry. There's not a, okay, not a trap door. But here's, and I'll keep it short. So the third point, the pro forma session, wasn't addressed below. It was briefed, it was pressed, but it wasn't passed upon. They argued it, but they wound up going off on in these kind of originalist bases. And it will be very interesting to see which ground the court addresses this on, because I do think that the pro forma sessions argument is fairly weak for the administration. And so I think that's the most vulnerable. But I also think that the Roberts Court naturally goes for what they think is the narrowest ground. And this may seem like the narrowest ground, because we got along for 223 years without it. But the fact of the matter is that the Senate wasn't the reason why we had these pro forma sessions. It was the House. Because neither House can go out for more than 3 days without getting the consent of the other. And so all the House had to do was withhold their consent for the Senate to go out for longer. Which means that unless all three branches are in the hands of the government and in the hands of the president's party, there could be pro forma sessions always to shut down the recess appointment power. And so in some ways, that's the biggest. I think the narrowest would probably be the happens to arise, happens to exist, because probably the people in the president's party, at least, would do him the favor of waiting until a recess to resign. So there still would be kind of a recess appointment power there anyway. But now I will move on to why you've been sitting here wasting your time, because it all doesn't really matter. And I only mean this partly facetiously, or a good bit facetiously, because basically recess appointments are the only show in town for things like independent boards like the NLRB and you know, bodies such as that. And it's certainly only the only show in town if you want to get a judge on the bench in a hurry. But the fact of the matter is that the Vacancies Reform Act, really obscure law, but it basically gives the government all sorts of flexibility to fill offices on a temporary basis with a great number of people. And there are people whose job it is just to know that law inside and out. And with a little bit of planning, they can get whoever they want, whoever the administration wants, into the position, and they can occupy it on an indefinite basis. I mean, not really, but I mean, the recess appointment here was a two-year recess appointment, essentially, because it was done on an intra-session basis rather than inter. We can discuss that when it's not on my time. The fact of the matter is you can get people in for the amount of time you need them under the Vacancies Reform Act. And it's kind of a peculiar thing that the Senate, by not confirming them, leaves these people out there who, you know, maybe they're more beholden to them because they hope someday to be confirmed, and maybe they're less beholden to them because they know that they're never going to be confirmed. But in any event, there is certainly, you can keep the government going in the executive branch, at least, I think, through the Vacancies Reform Act, which really takes a lot of the heat out of the room. Whichever way this case comes out, where it's really going to matter the most is in things like the NLRB. And I also think that all this really does is address the leverage of the two parties because, you know, the president can get people on the NLRB. He just has to play ball with the Senate and, you know, vice versa. So in a way, it's just setting the rules of the road. And as long as everybody knows the rules of the road, they should be able to make it work. So the republic will not end. And on those cheery words, I'll sit down.
Thank you so much, Judge Kethledge, for the great introduction, and thank you so much for having me here today. I always really enjoy being at the Federalist Society events. You know, even though I play for the other team, I love coming to the Federalist Society events because you guys really care about the text and history of the Constitution, as do I and my organization. And so even though we disagree many times on how that actually plays out, I enjoy that we both fully embrace our important founding documents. So on the particular issue today, you know, while this case may be a question of first impression for the Supreme Court, as Noel mentioned in his remarks, the political branches of our national government have been interpreting the recess appointments clause since George Washington was president. And I strongly disagree with Noel's interpretation of the history because I think that the political branches have overwhelmingly interpreted the recess appointments power in one particular way, and that's the way that the administration in this case interprets the recess appointment power, and the same way that the George W. Bush administration interpreted the recess appointments power back when they were defending the appointment of Judge Pryor. So I am, you know, in the spirit of being reasonable here today, I am willing to accept that my friend's reading of the text could make sense in a vacuum. But even if it could make sense in a vacuum, it's certainly not the only reading of the recess appointments clause, and certainly not the required reading of the recess appointments clause. So sure, the literal language of the clause could refer to vacancies that arose during the Senate's recess, but nothing suggests that this is the only possible meaning. I think the administration's reading is more faithful to the original meaning of the Constitution and has the benefit of being the interpretation that presidents and senates have chosen for pretty much the entirety of American history. At least 14 presidents have collectively made more than 600 civilian appointments during intra-session recesses and 1,000 more military appointments. And certainly, if you look through the government's brief in their appendix, which I think is very powerful just to see it all in writing, there are about 65 pages in their appendix of these intra-session recesses. And there are another additional 25 or so examples of appointments. And these are just illustrative appointments. They're not even the entire catalog of recess appointments made to fill vacancies that pre-existed the recesses during which they were made. That's the may happen point. And on this may happen point, as you can see in the government's appendix, recess appointments were made to fill vacancies that pre-existed the recesses during which they were made, going back to presidents George Washington, Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, gentlemen who presumably knew more than a little something about the meaning of the Constitution. So I look forward to seeing what Noel has up his sleeve, because he's a very good lawyer. So I look forward to seeing what he puts in his brief, because I think there's some very powerful history on the administration side. It's also very powerful to look at the purpose of the recess appointments clause. And the framers gave primary responsibility for appointing executive officers, as well as federal judges, to the president because they thought that vesting this responsibility in the executive would make for better appointments. I'm sure that Professor Rautabaugh would disagree with some of the appointments that President Obama has made to the NLRB, but the founders did think that vesting the appointments power in the president would result in a high quality of nominees. To be sure, the framers did give the Senate an important role in the appointments process, but they recognized that the president would be the one who would be perpetually on duty. He would be on the job 24/7, unlike the Senate. And so the framers wanted to be sure that when the Senate was unavailable to fulfill its advise and consent function, that the president could be sure to faithfully execute the laws and make sure the government was working, and thus could fill up vacancies. And by giving the president the power to fill up all vacancies that may happen during the recess of the Senate, the framers ensured that the president could fill any vacancies that existed when the Senate was unable to give its advise and consent, whether because it had ceased business between sessions or during a session. This interpretation is consistent with the framers' understanding of the word recess, which we get not just from old dictionaries, but also from the way that the word was used to refer to British Parliament, the way it was used during the state legislatures, practice at the founding era, and indeed even during the Constitutional Convention of 1787 itself. So as John mentioned, while the D.C. Circuit rested its holding in large part on the rarity of intra-session recess appointments during the founding period, the rarity of such appointments is readily explained by the rarity of intra-session recesses during this period. But as the significant use of intra-session recesses increased, so too do we see throughout history the use of intra-session recess appointments. So I think that it's very it's an uphill battle for Noel on the text of the recess appointments clause itself. What I think is perhaps a more difficult question is the question of the pro forma recess. I do think that this is probably something that's a little more concerning and a little more troubling, because the administration's position does have a bit of the sort of "we know it when we see it" flavor to it, and I think that that makes many of us very uncomfortable. You know, we do have the benefit of OLC memoranda, and but it does sort of have this kind of sense of, you know, you kind of have to trust the government to get it right. But, you know, there is something to the effect of OLC memoranda and the way that the political branches themselves have negotiated the use of recess appointments power over history. For almost 100 years, the express understanding of the executive branch is that the president will not use the recess appointments power for recesses that are fewer than 10 days. Even though there certainly have been some appointments during recesses 14 days, between 10 and 14 days. But basically, the government is saying, don't worry, we're not going to do it over lunchtime. And I think that while that might represent the most difficult case, it's certainly not this case. And I know judges and justices hate it when you don't answer the hypothetical, but with the answer of, well, that's not this case. But since I'm not before the court, let me just say that it's not this case. In this case, the facts are that the Senate expressly ordered that it would conduct no business during the entire 20-day period between January 3rd and 23rd, 2012. So the government isn't relying on the first session recess that Noel mentioned, this case in which there was actually some business conducted. It's looking at the 20-day period between January 3rd and 23rd, 2012. And the Senate did exactly that. It conducted no business, and all the hallmarks of a true recess were present. No work was done. No messages were laid before the Senate. While there were two messages that were delivered in this very formalistic way to the Senate, they were not actually laid before the full body of the Senate until the Senate came back from its recess, and its members were dispersed. All of these are part of the Senate's own definition of when it is in recess. So I think it's very important to recognize exactly what did happen during this particular recess, and that is pretty much nothing. The pro forma sessions lasted about 30 seconds. None of the standard hallmarks of a true work session happened. There was no Pledge of Allegiance. It was generally the gavel in, gavel out, sometimes about, I think it clocked it at about 29 seconds. And I think when you look at the functional argument here, the government has a strong point that the Senate shouldn't be able to use the strategy of seriatim pro forma sessions to extinguish the president's express constitutional authority to make recess appointments while simultaneously being unavailable itself to provide advice and consent. In this case, the Senate was absent in fact, but present only by virtue of a legal fiction. And the president was right to use his appointment power in this case. Now, to be sure, the Senate does have some control over the president's ability to exercise his recent appointment authority. If the Senate chooses to remain continually in session so it can act upon the president's nominees, then the Senate would be available to provide its advice and consent, and the use of the recess appointments power would not be necessary. But so long as the Senate has adjourned and advised the president and the public that it will not be conducting any business, the only way for the president to exercise his appointment authority and ensure that important executive and judicial branch offices remain filled is to use his recess appointment authority. But I think one of the backdrop, the backdrop reality here, which I think that those of us who are constitutional lawyers don't like to sort of drag ourselves down into, is this notion that there are politicians who are manipulating rules and custom to advance their political agendas. You know, and I think this is probably true on both sides of the aisle. I don't think any of us would say that the way that the appointments process, the nominations confirmation process is going right now is ideal. I do think the founders would be surprised at the current state of affairs of the appointments process. You know, you go back and look at what Alexander Hamilton wrote in Federalist Number 76, and he said that it was not very probable that the president's nominations would often be overruled by the Senate. I'm sure that's news to Nina Pillard and Patty Mallette, who are currently in limbo waiting to get confirmed to the D.C. Circuit.
I'd like to ask you a question.
just when you're done.
Okay.
I think, just to be able to get some interaction with the panel, we're just running a bit late.
Okay, well, I will wrap it up. But I think it's important not to maim the Constitution simply because there are politicians who might be trying to use it to purposes that are not ideal, particularly when the text and meaning of the Constitution are fairly clear and deeply ingrained practice has extended back over several hundred years. And I just want to close on the point that I don't think that this really should be a partisan issue. I don't think anyone who professes fidelity to the Constitution would want to make an argument that when Ronald Reagan does something, it's fine, but when Barack Obama does it, it's unconstitutional. You know, look, or vice versa. I think that Ted Kennedy got it wrong on the general scope of the recess appointment power when he opposed the appointment of Judge Pryor. I think he'd probably be wondering why his brief didn't get the support that Noel's clients are getting in this case, with every Republican senator having signed on to a brief at the certiorari stage arguing against President Obama's NLRB appointments. But the George
you didn't have as good a lawyer, I think.
I'm sure that's the case. But I think it's important to note that the George W. Bush administration zealously defended its recess appointment power, and that power was used by Presidents Bill Clinton, George H.W. Bush, and Ronald Reagan before him. This isn't something that Barack Obama just made up. Finally, I would note that you know, in addition to having to accept that if Barack Obama got it wrong, then so did Presidents Washington and Reagan, I think it's also important to think about what kind of constitutional theory, certainly not originalism from my perspective, is it that ignores how a constitutional text has been understood and actually applied since the founding in favor of a new, overly literalist reading of the Constitution that ignores 200 years of practice. I don't think the Supreme Court will bite at such meager bait, at least not the justices who think that the text and history of the Constitution count, which I hope, of course, is all of them. So now we can get to our questions.
It's hard for me to sit there and not be able to ask questions, you know. I'm used to interrupting at will. Elizabeth, let me start with you,
yep.
And I promise I'll try to ask Noel hard questions, too. I don't want you to feel like you're sort of, you know, being isolated here. But, you know, the three appointments here were all made one day into a new session of the Senate. They had the whole session before them, and the president makes those recess appointments then. As a practical matter, just looking at the reality of this, trying to get past the partisan excitement on each side, isn't that just a patent circumvention of the advice and consent requirement in the Constitution?
You know, I think that's a great question, and certainly questions were raised before when sort of at the other end, the president, previous presidents had waited until like the last day of the session of the recess. You know, again, it's sort of, well, why couldn't they just wait one more day when the Senate was back to make that appointment instead of using the recess appointment's power? So, you know, I think that criticism transcends this administration.
Sure.
But I think it does also get to the point that I made about, you know, there is this sort of backdrop of politicians being politicians. And
but, I mean, isn't it, though, I mean, regardless of who's doing it, they're doing it to circumvent the advice and consent requirement. I mean, that's the reality, isn't it?
What I think is important is not messing up the interpretation of the Constitution's text and history in order to punish a particularly egregious, perhaps, manipulation of those rules. So I think sort of taking the criticism and perhaps even if there were some backlash in the political branches, a lot of times after a use of the recess appointment power, there is then this, we saw this in the George W. Bush administration as well, then there was sort of a new compromise between the Senate and the President on appointments. You know, that can happen, but I think it's important not to make bad law out of that particular political situation.
Okay.
And Judge, may I?
Yeah,
only because I think that's a great question that also underscores why I think that the administration is wrong textually, even if you put aside the history. Remember, the recess appointments clause doesn't refer to the recess in the vacuum. It says that the president can make an appointment during the recess, and it lasts until the end of the next session. The reason why the president waited until January 4th was because he effectively bought an entire new year for his recess appointees. They get all the rest of this session plus the next one, the end of the next session. Well, textually, why would that make sense? Why would the recess, during which you get to make an appointment, be the period between two daily sessions, but the session that defines when the recess appointments end be the formal session as opposed to the two daily sessions in between which the recess occurs? So if you were to accept the government's textual argument, what it should really mean is the president, sure, he gets to make a very short recess appointment. You can pop the person in during the recess that occurs in between two daily sessions. That appointment then lasts until the end of the next daily session. So if it's really an emergency, you get to put your guy in there for a week. Why on earth, though, would you have a system where making a disfavored appointment, one that was largely unknown to history, gets an entire extra year relative to a traditional recess appointment. And remember, 2 years is a long time. That's half a presidential administration. That's a term of a member of Congress, and it's about how long most presidentially appointed people serve in office. So I think that's kind of a textual schizophrenia that the administration's position really can't come to terms with.
All right, so for you, Noel, doesn't your interpretation really allow the Senate very easily to render this recess appointment clause a nullity, even by just the very simple device of not adjourning sine die, which is at the end of a session, until the beginning of the next session?
It does make it easy for Senates to prevent recess appointments. And on this point, I would agree with Elizabeth. Either political branch here can game the system. But the way I look at it, when you step back, if you're going to game the system in a particular direction, it ought to be gamed in a way that preserves the principal mode of appointment, which is subject to advice and consent. Remember, the recess appointments clause was largely meant to be an emergency where senators were gone on horseback and they really had no ability to provide advice and consent. Well, in today's modern age, you can reconvene the Senate in an instant, and in fact, the president has the power under the Constitution to force the Senate to convene, and with modern technology can force them to convene in an instant if they do disperse. So you would expect that in today's day and age, there would be a smaller recess appointment power, not a larger recess appointment power. But in fact, what you see is the administration arguing for a massive recess appointment power such that it really does become the principal method for appointing, whereby simply timing your appointments properly, you can effectively put whoever you want into office and completely bypass the Senate and keep them there for two full years.
And Elizabeth, I guess I'd like to get your thoughts on that, and John, too. You look very pensive right now. I want to elicit whatever is happening in your mind right now. But, I mean, there is an irony here, and it's an awkward one, I would think, for your position, perhaps, that 200 years ago, 220 years ago, recesses might be 6 or 9 months, and it would be extremely difficult, if not impossible, to reconstitute the Senate quickly during that time. Now, recesses, I think, as the government's brief points out, it can last for, you know, just a moment. Intercession, I'm talking about. And communication, I mean, the Senate's never incommunicado. They can always get a hold of people over there. So isn't it ironic that now, when it would seem we would have less technical or logistical need for recess appointments than we did way back then, we're having many more of these appointments than we did then?
You know, I don't think that this president has used the appointments power as much as previous administrations. You can look at the list in the appendix to the government's brief. But, you know, I agree with you that, you know, we are in a different situation now. We do have, you know, even our furthest flung senators can get back to D.C. in a matter of days. But the Constitution is what the Constitution is. And I think that, again, maiming the words and the meaning of the Constitution to fit today's political reality is not really what I would think is the best solution to that.
Okay. And John, when you were at OLC, you were just spending days going through dusty records of the 1910s and 20s, et cetera, right?
That was my average day, yeah.
Okay, that's right.
It definitely involved dust mites.
So, I mean, at least as I understand the government's brief, the SG's brief, as all their briefs are, really well done. The only presidents who made intra-session recess appointments, as I understand it, before the 1940s when things kind of went crazy, in Noel's view, were Andrew Johnson, Warren Harding, and Herbert Hoover, which is not exactly kind of a presidential hall of fame here. Andrew Johnson, in my opinion, the worst ever. You know, we'll just leave it there. I mean, how debilitating should that be to the government's case, and how seriously should OLC be taking that when they size this up?
The important thing, I think, or the best thing that can be said about it is that When there were substantial intra-session recesses, there were intra-session recess appointments. It just happened that Congress's own practices didn't call for them before then. One thing that has interested me is that my own understanding, which is not necessarily the gospel truth, and I look forward to reading Noel's brief on this, is that despite the fact that people complained about virtually everything Andrew Johnson did, I'm not aware that they complained about this practice. Did they?
No, it didn't garner much attention. Yeah. But it's interesting, if you look at Andrew Johnson's attorney general opinions about these appointments, it was kind of a unique period in history. For one of the first times in history, the Senate took two adjourned sessions within a single session. So they had a long subsession, followed by a break, followed by another long subsession. And the Andrew Johnson's attorney general opinions understand these to be two different sessions for purposes of the recess appointments clause. So although I think these opinions aren't quite right, they're not nearly what the government is asserting here, because the recess appointment would only last until the end of the second adjourned session. So it still did understand that you're either in recess or you're in session. And so the recess appointment only lasts as long as the period of work that follows the break during which you made the appointment. That's basically consistent with our position, not perfectly, but it's wildly inconsistent with the notion that a recess occurs during any break between sessions, but then the session that defines the length of the appointment is not the working session, but the formal session. Why does the recess in the recess appointments clause refer to a colloquial recess, but the session in the recess appointments clause refers to the formal session? What possible justification is there for that textual asymmetry, except for if your only goal is to maximize executive power? There's no other rationale for it. And that's why nobody until I think it was the Comptroller General in 1948, understood that you could simultaneously be in recess and in session at the same time.
Okay. My biggest problem in this particular situation is, as we do in labor law, we look at timing as indicative sometimes of motive, and I just don't know how you can keep a straight face when the vacancies occurred months in advance, and all of a sudden they're nominated 2 days before, I believe his name is Harry Reid, I think he's a Democrat, and I wonder if he was communicating with the White House, and you see, we'll adjourn, and I mean, the timing here makes the argument weak to me. I mean, in this particular situation, to nominate, adjourn, and then slam in, there was no effort at all to give the Senate the opportunity to provide the president with their advice.
So can you give us an example on the other side?
Well, I believe that the president did have nominations pending for about a year before he made the recess appointments.
Were they the same folks that we're talking about? I mean, the same three people?
Two of the three were new. One had been around for a while.
One had been around for almost a year, and the other two were made on the 15th of
and
December.
And so, I mean, to the extent that one of these folks was already a nominee and didn't get confirmed, I mean, isn't that a bit problematic? I mean, it's a bit problematic, isn't it?
I think that, first of all, it's not something that is unique to this administration. It happened in Republican administrations as well.
Yeah.
But I'm not here to defend, the politics of what goes on the Hill.
The issue transcends, frankly, one board of
everybody's ox
gets
scored.
I mean, this isn't really about, Joe Smith's appointment and whatever date. Noel, I wanted to ask you, obviously you've got three different issues here. The happens to exist issue. Mm-hmm. It would seem like you have a pretty good historical case to make about the intercession, or at least the sort of unprecedented nature of intra-session recess appointments before the 40s. But you've got a tough historical case with respect to this happens business.
It's certainly not as clean. I think we've got a stronger textual case. We've got a strong historical case, and I would take issue with Elizabeth's characterization of the first four presidents. They all publicly acknowledged and adhered to the notion that the vacancy had to arise during the recess. What the government has attempted to do in their brief, and it's a very good brief, they've not found anything where anybody actually says that they think other than what they publicly said, which is that the vacancy has to arise during the recess. They all agree with that. They purport to have unearthed a small handful of recess appointments where, if you trace through the old records, it looks like, at least in some instances, maybe the vacancy did happen to occur before the recess. So it really, the argument boils down to this. Yes, they all publicly said one thing, but they secretly believed otherwise, and we've unearthed a couple of examples that prove what their secret beliefs that they never articulated actually were. Mm-hmm. That strikes me as a pretty weak argument. If you take George Washington, for example, the two examples that the government cites, if you look at George Washington's public letters appointing these people, he describes their vacancies as having occurred during the recess. That's what he writes. Maybe he was lying. Maybe he just didn't know what the facts were. But I think that what he said, what he described as happening to justify his power, is a lot more probative than whether or not we can retrace through the archives to find out whether or not he made a mistake. So, I think the history is very compelling. And if you also look at the Senate, until 1940, the Senate refused to accord any pay to any recess appointee whose vacancy arose prior to the recess. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it's at all fair to say that you had Senate acquiescence in this until at least 1940. And even then, I would say they weren't acquiescing. They just, you know, maybe they weren't seeking impeachment, maybe they weren't trying to shut down the government, but they were doing lots of things to try to push back on what was an ever-expanding recess appointment power.
Doesn't the happens interpretation, though, have the potential to change the status quo with respect to the balance of power between the executive and legislature in the Senate right now, more so than your intercession argument? I mean, it's 190 years they've been doing this.
Perhaps. I mean, I think either of the two arguments are going to change the status quo if you define the status quo as to what people understood the rule was before this case.
Mm-hmm.
Because, the one thing I can't argue with Elizabeth about is that the presidents have been doing these things for a very long time, presidents of both political parties. But if you look at it relative to what the right principle is, then I think that both of these, as well as the three-day rule, is right.
I'll ask one more question, then we'll let the folks out here ask some questions. This fight really seems like it's a fight about allocation of power between the executive and the Senate. And what seems to be at stake here is it's kind of a zero sum, to some extent, between the recess appointment clause and the advice and consent clause. And to the extent the president's power is greater under the recess clause, it may detract from the need for advice and consent. Advice and consent is such a critical part of our constitutional checks and balances. I mean, most fifth graders could tell you what that is, I hope. recess appointment clause, not so much, right? I mean, it wasn't discussed much in the Constitutional Convention, as Noel pointed out. So if the court has to make a choice about which one of these to jeopardize, which clause to favor in its interpretation, shouldn't it favor the vibrancy of the advice and consent clause rather than try to favor a recess appointment clause, which may have outlived some of its usefulness?
I think that that's not really the court's decision to make. I think that what they should do is follow the balance that the framers struck when they wrote these provisions into the Constitution. And, you know, the point of the recess appointments power was to enable the president to be on duty 24/7 to make appointments when the Senate was unavailable to give its advice and consent. So they certainly saw this as being an exception to the advice and consent function Now, I think we can argue about whether or not that power has been overused or manipulated, but I don't think that the court should, and I don't think it's job to rewrite the Constitution in that way.
John, do you have any thoughts on that before we turn it over here?
You know, it's funny because I think as a practical matter, there's no question, as I said from the outset, that you could really get along for most cases, not for NLRB and independent agencies, things like that, without the Reese's Appointment Clause. And so if there were any sort of tension, it does seem to be, you know, go with the Appointments Clause as opposed to the Recess Appointments Clause. But, you know, there is, I don't know, there's a little bit too much living Constitution about that, you know, in other ways. Because it is that the, you know, if we do things the way that the framers actually intended, you know, it should work pretty well. The one thing I will say, though, is that, you know, the framers put an inordinate weight on keeping offices filled. You know, I think that if we applied it the way the challengers say, in some practical ways, it would work better, because it would make it much tougher to use recesses as your chance to get through all the people who the other party doesn't like. That's one thing that impressed me, is how little heat Reese's appointments generated during the first, you know, 40-some years of the Constitution, because there really weren't quite such abuses of the Reese's appointment power.
All right, why don't we take a few questions? Anybody? Mr. Kirk?
People at the mics.
Mics? Oh, yeah, we got. Oh, okay, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Go ahead, and then we'll.
Sure. Absolutely. It is one of the textual features that suggests that we're right. It's not by any means the only one. But they did refer to the recess of the Senate and the next session. And that suggests that they weren't referring to any recess, because any recess would really mean lunch. Seriously, if you look at the Senate Journal, they describe the break from 12 to 2 as a recess. We're going into recess from 12 to 2. It cannot be that the Constitution meant for there to be recess appointments during those 2 hours. So yes, the recess signifies that they're not referring to any recess. And it's not the recess, it's the recess of the Senate. That's referring to something specific. When you juxtapose that to the next session, which everyone agrees is the formal session, not the session that occurs between 2 o'clock and 5 o'clock, as opposed to 9 o'clock and 12 o'clock, when you juxtapose it to the next session, I think that the textual cue is inexorable, that what you're talking about is the formal recess of the Senate.
All right, gentlemen over here at the mic.
Yeah, Richard Samp with the Washington Legal Foundation. Noel mentioned earlier about Senate acquiescence at times in what was going on. Why is it not a permissible solution to this case simply to say that a majority of the Senate very clearly has acquiesced to what went on here, while a minority of Republican senators have not? The majority has acquiesced, just as a majority acquiesced to the recess appointment of Judge Pryor. When you've got a dispute between the executive branch and the legislative branch, that might be a good reason for the courts to get involved. But when they're clearly not in dispute, okay, in this case, why get involved?
Go ahead.
I mean, to me, and Judge, you made the same point, that this is a fight between the branches, but it's not. My client is the Noel Canning Company. Noel Canning is not in the Senate. Noel Canning is not in the executive branch. And the structural protections of the Constitution are not meant to protect the branches against each other. The constitutional structural protections are meant to protect entities like Noel Canning, private parties, from the government. The Bill of Rights was an afterthought. The framers thought that individual rights were protected by the Constitution's structure. And the debate over the Bill of Rights was whether we even needed one at all. Why on earth do we need a First Amendment, many argued? Because the government doesn't have the power to infringe on free speech. They can only do these 10 little things. They can't infringe on free speech. So the structural protections are meant to protect liberty of individuals. Why is it that we think that the branches can bargain away the structural protections of the Constitution any more than they can bargain away the First Amendment?
Okay, yeah, I don't think this I don't think this will get any applause, but I view it as not as a adverse possession thing that the branches of government can bargain it away. I think it's more of a matter of when the text is ambiguous, or to the extent it's ambiguous, the historic conduct of the branches is relevant to interpreting it.
You can applaud for that too.
Gentleman over here.
Hi, Trevor Burris from the Cato Institute. I
just
question.
Try to keep it tight because
yeah.
You know,
Elizabeth, you on your pro forma questions, which I think you're correct. That's the real difficulty here, but you put a lot of emphasis on the no business conducted element of the OLC memo. Since I was writing our brief in this case this morning, I want to point you to page 21 of the OLC memo, where they talk about the no business conducted, but immediately after they say that, they say this: moreover, even absent the Senate pronouncement that it will not conduct business, there may be circumstances in which the president could properly conclude that the body is not available to provide advice and consent. So he takes away his arbitrary, he gives a non-arbitrary standard, then he takes it right back. And are you okay with that? That really this is not about defining a recess of the Senate, it's about defining a session of the Senate and the president doing that on an arbitrary standard that he gives himself in this memo?
You know, I think you have both the executive's understanding of the recess, which is more than just no business conducted. You have the Senate's understanding of a recess, which under the Senate's own definition, the lunch break does not qualify because in addition to no business being conducted, the members are dispersed, which I presume they mean more than just down to the cafeteria, and no messages can be officially laid before the body. So, you know, there are other hallmarks of what constitutes a recess, but I agree with you, that's the hardest point here because we don't like that it's somewhat squishy. We want it to have a more defined meaning, but I think between the executive and the Senate's and the historical understanding of what a recess means, that's where we give meaning to that term.
This gentleman over here.
This question is mostly for Elizabeth, but the other panelists could jump in on it. You were saying that you had this very long appendix which listed all the uses of the recess appointments by people of both parties. I remember seeing such a similar appendix in the dissent of Justice White in INS v. Chadha, which was the case that struck down the use of the legislative veto. The legislative veto was a very popular thing. It had been done by Congresses of both parties, and the Supreme Court took a very formless approach and said, no, it is bicameralism and presentment or nothing. So what makes you think that the Supreme Court, or at least this Supreme Court, will go with your interpretation as opposed to a more strict formless interpretation as they did in Chadha?
So it's the SG's brief that has the appendix. I wish it were in my brief, but it's not. You know, I think that that's a great question, and clearly historical practice is not enough. We saw Justice Kennedy make this point in the legislative prayer case just last week. But I think it's the overwhelming historical practice and agreement on what the clause means, as well as the text of the provision and the original meaning. So I think that if we were solely hanging our hat on the fact that everyone has done it, that's an insufficient reason, but I think when you add that to the text and history of the Constitution, it's a compelling argument.
All right, we'll try to accommodate the last two standing questioners over here.
Ray Lajeunesse. For full disclosure, I'm also with the National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation. My question is a practical one for John Roundabout. One of the arguments the government makes is that if the court upholds the D.C. Circuit's position, the board will be faced with this horrible disruption of having to deal with thousands of cases that were invalidly decided. Is there a prior example where this kind of thing has happened before?
New Process Steel. New Process Steel, the aftermath, the cases were, quote, reconsidered, end of quote. They did issue rather quickly. But they were completely, as I understand, talking with some of the individuals who were on that, they actually did go back and revisit the cases. Now, at the same time, what was interesting when Chairman Liebman and Board Member Schomburg, and then it switched, but at any rate, the two of them took the approach of only issuing decisions where both agreed. So we don't have the degree of contentiousness that we see in some of the cases that issued here with the recess appointees, where you had cases with one dissent in quite a few of these, in which case now with new individuals on the board, I'm quite convinced that they will be fully reconsidered.
Okay, and this gentleman here, sturdy questioner.
Yep. Mike Stern, very quick question on the Senate. Does anyone disagree that the Senate was capable of doing business by unanimous consent during the pro forma sessions? And secondly, do you disagree or do you have a view as to whether or not the Senate could have done business if a quorum, a majority of the Senate, showed up at one of the pro forma sessions?
They approved legislation. The vast majority of nominees, the vast majority of legislation in this country is actually passed by the Senate by unanimous consent. And in fact, in these Senate sessions, we have no clue whether there was actually a quorum of senators there. No clue. The official record is the Senate Journal. The Senate Journal says nothing about this. Just like most Senate sessions, there is no indication as to whether a quorum is actually present. Because under the Senate's rules, there is an absolute presumption that a quorum exists unless somebody makes a quorum call and establishes that a quorum doesn't exist. That's why if you flip on C-SPAN on any given day, you'll often see, it'll look, as far as you're concerned, like there's very few people on the Senate floor other than maybe the presiding senator and one or two walking around, yet nonetheless, they're actually passing legislation and confirming nominees. It's because under the Senate's rules, there is a quorum until somebody proves that there's not one.
It's called a quorum call.
In these sessions, nobody made a quorum call. So as far as the official Senate Journal reflects, every senator was there, or at the very least, every senator was standing in the cloakroom waiting to walk onto the floor as soon as they needed to be. And there is not a shred of evidence in the official records of the Senate to the contrary. These records, in that respect, look just like any other Senate Journal record in terms of how many senators were or were not present.
Elizabeth, last word?
Yeah, I was going to say, except for the explicit Senate order that says no business will be conducted, giving assurance to the members that they can go back to their home districts, even those across the country, and be sure that no business would be conducted in their absence.
Well, very good. I want to thank all our panelists, and please thank them.
Very good.